Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, the House voted to defund President Obama's signature Affordable Health Care Act on party lines. What does this polarized Congress mean for the future of U.S. policy? Then, climate change, receding glaciers, and melting ice sheets are causing the oceans to rise dramatically. What does that mean for the world's coastal cities? Finally, what most of the world has gotten wrong about Muslim fundamentalism. On the heels of a vote to reduce the food stamp program, the House of Representatives on Friday voted to defund President Obama's Affordable Care Act, but voted to keep government funded. The vote was on party lines and came after Speaker John Boehner rejected the strategy earlier by most conservative Republicans. What does this polarization mean for the future of U.S. policy? We have two experts with us. Sean Theriault is professor of government at the University of Texas at Austin. His most recent book is The Gingrich Senators. He's also the author of The Power of the People, Congressional Competition, Public Attention, and Voter Retribution. Peter Hansen also joins us. Peter Hansen is a professor of political science at the University of Denver. His publications include a forthcoming book on majority power in the U.S. Senate. Welcome, Peter Hansen. Welcome, Sean Theriault. Great to have you back on the Scholar Circle. We just had this vote that occurred on Friday to defund the Affordable Care Act, but to keep the government running. This is the second time in modern history that we've been faced with a real shutdown in federal government. The other time, which I think happened twice during Bill Clinton's administration. Sean Theriault, are they similar or are they different?
So I would say the dynamics are pretty similar in that you have a unified and ideologically and in terms of strategy majority party in the House that's confronting a president that doesn't think the same thing. And one side or the other is going to have to give in order for the government to continue running as it's been running lately.
So there was an article that said that actually the Republican Party was divided and then Speaker Boehner caved in. It sounded a little bit reminiscent of what you were talking about with Newt Gingrich in your book, Sean Theriault. Would you say there's some similarities there?
So it's divided in that there's 20 people who truly are on the side of John Boehner and want to see a solution come about where the government continues running. But then almost the entire rest of the caucus is on the other side. And I would say there is a big difference between speakership of Newt Gingrich and John Boehner. I think John Boehner, at the end of the day, wishes that he could be a problem solver. And I'm not sure that description I would ever use to talk about Newt Gingrich. Of course, there were, over the span of his career, of course, we have welfare reform and a couple of times when he was a problem solver. But more often than not, I think that he liked to engage in the partisan war and see where it led. And of course, when the Republicans did shut down the government back in the Clinton administration, it was Newt Gingrich that bore a lot of the blame from that. And I'm not sure that he ever fully recovered from that.
So it's quite possible that there's a not fully recover from a government shutdown again.
It's going to be hard for John Boehner because I think in his heart of hearts, he hopes that there's not a shutdown. He'll do everything in his power to ensure that there's not. But I think at the end of the day, I'm not sure he has the number of votes that he's going to need in order to make sure that the government can continue running. And so I'm not sure how the internal dynamics play out between who gets to blame Boehner versus the Tea Party Republicans in the House. But what's clear is the Republican Party overall, I think, is pretty clearly going to get the blame for this shutdown, as it did back in the Clinton administration.
Peter Hansen, would you agree with this?
Yeah, I think Sean's made a lot of really good points there. I just build on a couple of things. You know, in the book I'm working on, one of the things I do is study the appropriations process, and I spend a long time talking about the government shutdown in the 1990s. Congressional staff members I interviewed for the book who served during that time agree that it was a disaster for the Republicans. Many of them still work on Capitol Hill, and they view the new Tea Party Republicans in the House as being really too aggressive, and they think that this push for a shutdown is really disastrous for the party. One staff member I interviewed for the book described the shutdown in the 1990s as like Pickett's charge during the Civil War. If you remember the disastrous Confederate charge during the Battle of Gettysburg that led to the destruction of part of the Confederate Army, there's that apocalyptic sense about a shutdown among some of these long-serving Republicans, and I think they're genuinely worried about where it will take them.
Now, do you think that the electorate has perhaps moved so ideologically following some of these that we won't see as much of a dramatic, what should we call it, punishment to those who enacted this? Peter Hansen.
The Republicans held on to the House in the wake of the 1995-96 shutdown, so they weren't punished that much electorally. On the other hand, if you follow what happened to them in the budget process afterwards, they really suffered some severe policy losses. So they did okay in the initial shutdown. But in subsequent years, President Clinton really cleaned their clock. I mean, they were so afraid of being blamed for another shutdown that they were put in the position of giving Clinton much of what he wanted in subsequent years. And so, you know, I agree with Sean that if the government shuts down again, Republicans will probably receive the bulk of the blame. And from a policy standpoint, I think it's really bad for them. I think it will make it much harder for them to negotiate an uneven footing in the future.
Now, as I have been hearing rumblings, Boehner actually caved in partly to rescue his speakership, whereas Eric Cantor may be angling to take over the speakership. Do you see this as a real assessment, Sean Theriault?
I mean, I think that everyone has been waiting and waiting for Cantor to go after Boehner in a serious way, and he hasn't pulled the trigger yet. Now, I don't think this is the issue on which he would pull the trigger. I think that Eric Cantor certainly is more sympathetic to the Tea Party Republicans, but at the end of the day, I think that even he, in his heart of hearts, would not want to see that strategy be invoked in this particular instance. So I suspect I think that John Boehner's speakership is going to come to a natural end, and Eric Cantor is going to step in and replace him. I don't think that you're going to see a coup or anything like that, especially in the next couple months. The Republicans just simply have too much at stake. If I could just follow up a little bit on what Peter said, I think that the parallel between where Clinton was in 1995 and where Obama is today, the Republicans shouldn't lose sight of that. I mean, it was because of the shutdown that Clinton got his mojo back, you know, and then he ended up coasting towards re-election, of course, where that was the first term versus the second term for Obama. But right now, Obama's, I think otherwise, is struggling a little bit. He's trying to figure out where he's relevant, how he can still have an important role in the process. And I think that if the Republicans escalate this, he just becomes the face of the Democratic Party, the face of problem solvers. And I think that it re-energizes him in a way that I'm not entirely sure the Tea Party Republicans really want to happen.
Given the way this seems to be more frequent threats to shut down the government, are we dealing with a new normal, Peter Hansen?
There are some precedents to shutting down the government, but they were very, very brief. They occurred in the early 1980s when Ronald Reagan and Congress were engaged in a dispute over Reagan's proposed cuts to federal spending. And Reagan actually did veto a budget bill that led to a very brief government shutdown. And Congress was so afraid of being blamed for this that they essentially caved into Reagan's demands immediately and gave him what he wanted. You know, if you look at that example and you look at the example that we've been talking about with the shutdown during the Clinton administration, it's really likely that Congress comes out as the loser on any kind of confrontation like this. I think it's a very dangerous strategy.
Well, let's move into the Senate side of things. Both of you are experts on the Senate. Sean Theriault, how do you see the dynamics in the Senate now? And what are the rumblings of the Gingrich protégés that are there?
Right. What's really interesting is just a story in the last 24 hours about how upset the House Republicans are with Ted Cruz, in that he, in essence, has already capitulated the fight in the Senate and said it's over. I mean, he's going to try as hard as he can, but at the end of the day, he doesn't even have the 41 votes to engage in a successful filibuster. So I think that you're going to see some speech making. You're going to see Harry Reid invoke cloture, and then you're going to see a vote. And I bet at the end of the day, you're going to have about 20 Republicans who will support the House Republican strategy. But the overwhelming majority of folks, I think, are going to vote against it. And the bill is not going to go back to the House without the defunding of Obamacare in it. And then we're going to really see what happens both with John Boehner, Eric Cantor, and the rest of the House Republicans. And I would expect that the Tea Party folks in the Senate will remain pretty unified. Of course, the three of them are leading it, Marco Rubio and Mike Lee and Ted Cruz. And I suspect they're going to be joined by a good number of the Gingrich senators.
Peter Hansen, you're also an expert on the Senate. How are these dynamics going to be different, and how will they continue forth after this fight?
Well, I think Sean's given a nice summary of probably what will happen immediately in the Senate. You know, the Senate right now, for all of its flaws, is really the only place in Congress where legislation is being passed and problems are being solved. If you just look at recent history, with the last fight over the debt ceiling or the immigration bill, it's the Senate where compromises are able to take place. So, of course, I think Sean's right. I think this continuing resolution now will go to the Senate, and it will be adopted without the House provision that seeking to defund Obamacare. Then it will go back to the House. And then the decision for John Boehner will become quite interesting, because if you look back at the recent history of the House, the only times they've really been able to successfully pass legislation that's gone on to the president to be signed is when Boehner has essentially brought a bill to the floor that will pass with majority support from the Democrats and minority support from Republicans. This is a terrible position for him to be in as Speaker. It's the sort of action that I think does put his speakership at risk. But I think the fact is he doesn't have a working coalition within his own party right now. So if he does become serious about ensuring that the government gets funded, he might have to rely on Democrats to help him do that.
In terms of turning it back to the voters and the future of the institution, and the question I had earlier about, you know, are we dealing with a new normal, is this dysfunction now the natural part of U.S. governance, or do you see change coming in the future, Sean Theriault?
So this dysfunction comes right out of the election results. So in 2006 and 2008, you had huge victories for Democrats, and then you had the handcuffs placed on them by a huge Republican majorities in the House in the 2010 election, and that pattern has really persisted now for the last 3 or 4 years. And so it is the new normal, that is, until the American public says, all right, this is enough, and it gives a decisive, clear win to one or the other parties in as much that they can have an enacting coalition to get their policies passed. But as long as you have divided government and as long as you have the American mind flip-flopping, this is what you get. This is what Madison guaranteed in setting up the government the way it was.
Right. And not actually planning very well for parties.
Right.
Peter Hansen.
Yeah, I agree with Sean, and I'd simply make one further point, which is that, you know, the House of Representatives right now, the House Republicans are a good reflection of their districts. You know, one of the differences between the House and the Senate is that states, when you simply average together all the people within them, are much more moderate than voters in House districts. House districts tend to be pretty homogenous, and they tend to be pretty safe. So they're lopsided either toward one party or the other. And so part of the problem we have is I think House Republicans are actually following the electoral incentives that they have to continue to win in their district. So by following the marching orders of their voters, they are contributing to this overall policy problem we have right now. In terms of where we go in the future, you know, I always think it's important to remember that, you know, we're just at one particular moment in American history, and our population is changing, and a lot of things about the country are changing. I mean, we're going through a massive demographic change right now in the country, and there's been some really interesting discussion about what this means for what our future electorate will look like. And so I think the safest thing to say is that the current dynamic we have right now is certainly going to change, I think, in ways we can't really predict. And, you know, hopefully it'll change in a way that will help Congress to be a little more productive.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Right, thank you, Maria.
Sean Theriault is professor of government at the University of Texas at Austin. His most recent book is The Gingrich Senators. He's also the author of The Power of the People, Congressional Competition, Public Attention, and Voter Retribution. Peter Hansen is a professor of political science at the University of Denver. His publications include a forthcoming book on majority power in the U.S. Senate. You're listening to The Scholar's Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. Average global sea levels will rise by 20 to 30 feet, say researchers. What could the rise mean for coastal cities all over the Earth? Two experts join us. Andrea Dutton is a professor in the Department of Geological Sciences at the University of Florida. She is the author of Ice Volumes and Sea Level During the Last Interglacial that was recently published in the journal Science. Brian Fagan is an emeritus professor of anthropology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He's the author of more than 40 books, including his latest, The Attacking Ocean, The Past, Present, and Future of Rising Sea Levels. Welcome, Andrea Dutton, Brian Fagan. Great to have you both with us. Brian Fagan, I want to begin with you, your research for the book, The Attacking Ocean. Let's start with where you start, the Ice Age. Sea levels, you said, were something like 120 meters lower than they are today. But the change was gradual. How did this start and come up to where we are today?
Well, basically, over the last 10,000 years, as I understand it, there was a fairly rapid rise after the Ice Age when warming began. It was irregular, but the rising continued. And then about 6,000 BC, maybe around there, maybe a little later, things stabilized. And there was a long period when there were very minor changes. And then after 1860, the rise has resumed, and I believe now is accelerating. So it's a sort of pattern of stop and start.
The rise that was occurring before the stable period, what do we know about what was causing it then?
This is really, I think, more in Andrew's area than mine. But what was going on was that the Ice Age was ending. There was widespread global warming. There was extensive melting of the ice sheets which covered North America and covered Scandinavia and elsewhere. And sea levels began to rise with this discharge of meltwater into the ocean, and then you also got very complex and little understood adjustments of the Earth's crust going on, which varied considerably from one area to another. And the result was that the geography of much of the world changed. I mean, Scandinavia and Alaska were separated. The continental shelf that practically joined Southeast Asia to Australia was vanished underwater. You've got the North Sea was flooded by 5500 BC. England was separated from the Channel, and so on. There were very, very radical changes, this apart from changes in vegetation and so on. But the shifts in recent years have been, quite dramatic. What is going on at the moment, I'm told, is a little more cooling than usual. So the point about climate change and all these things is that they're not regular. They vary tremendously. And you get cycles where not much happened, then you get a cycle where things happened. And this is true of all climate change.
Andrea Dutton, let's bring you in. Now, you've also looked back as far as the Ice Age. Why do we start there?
What we were just talking about, coming out of this last Ice Age, this is a time period when you had large ice sheets covering vast portions of the Northern Hemisphere. And as we were just talking about, those ice sheets retreated and sea level rose. And then it stabilized somewhat. So when we're talking about sea level change, and particularly looking into the future, we don't actually really want to be thinking about the changes that happened between the Ice Age and today. That was a very different dynamic of these ice sheets over these large continents in the Northern Hemisphere. What we really want to understand now is what's happening to these large polar ice sheets that we still have in Greenland and Antarctica, and what's going to happen to them as we go into the future. So that's the reason my research actually focuses on periods of time in the past that are warm periods when we had ice sheets in a similar configuration to today, so meaning ice on Greenland and Antarctica, to understand how sensitive those ice sheets are to changes in temperature.
I suppose that is what you meant by radiative forcing?
Yes, right. So one of the main drivers, of course, is how much of the sun's energy is coming into the Earth at a given time. And so one of the periods that I study is called the last interglacial. So that's before the last ice age, when sea levels were higher than today. But the temperatures were pretty similar, but a few degrees warmer at the poles. And one difference back then is that the Northern Hemisphere was receiving a lot more solar radiation during the summertime, which we think had something to do with the warmer temperatures there. What we're looking at today, though, is a very different scenario. So what's driving the climate change? The changes are, for one thing, happening much faster. Temperature is changing much faster. And the forcing in terms of the increase in temperature is global scale. It's not focused just in the Northern Hemisphere. The increase in CO2 in our atmosphere is causing the entire globe to warm.
Brian Fagan?
I agree with that. I mean, she's dealing with a whole new generation of research, which is very exciting. And the point is, you can't look at climate change except globally, and we tended to focus on the Northern Hemisphere.
You actually opened your book with these storms that are occurring, particularly with Katrina and Sandy, and how massive they have become and more frequent they have become. How are these things related? How come climate change translates into these storms, and how is that all related to sea level?
The most important thing about rising sea levels and extreme weather events, and I believe the climatologists, and Jim, they know more about this than I do, are forecasting that there were going to be, or predicting there were going to be many more severe events. The big real threat, human-wise, is obviously strong winds and so on, but it is the sea surges which accompany these and which inundate densely populated coastal areas, of which, of course, New Jersey is one. The real serious problem in the immediate future is Bangladesh, which is, as you know, very prone to cyclones. And this whole area, which lies very close to sea level, has very dense populations in the millions. And the effects of this mean that millions of people are basically losing their land permanently in the long term, apart from the dangers of contamination of groundwater and so on. And we're going to be facing an issue of environmental refugees, which is going to get very serious globally, I think.
You actually mentioned a few other places in the book in addition to Bangladesh. You talked about the Pacific Islands. You mentioned the Bahamas. You mentioned Vietnam. What is the scope as a big problem for issues of climate refugees?
The big issue is acceptance. For example, if you take Bangladesh, and let's say, just for the sake of argument, they need to move 10 million people, where are they going to go? They're not going to go to Myanmar, and Myanmar doesn't want them. India doesn't want them. Apart from political and social stresses, they have serious problems themselves. And the only alternative is to develop international policies which deal with a very, very difficult problem, which is the moving of subsistence farmers who have very close emotional relationships to their land into countries that will accept them, where they have no skills which are useful in a modern industrial economy. And this is a very, very serious problem because it intersects problems in every single nation and areas like South Dakota, where I'm sitting, which are hundreds of miles from the ocean, because where are people going to go?
And there's also vulnerable parts in the U.S. you mentioned. You said it was concentrated in the South.
Mainly in the South because of the nature of the shoreline and the just the geology and so on. And the parts of the East are very vulnerable. The West Coast is not quite so bad. But the real problem areas beyond the Arctic, obviously, are places like Shanghai, low-lying areas where there really are millions of people in the way in urban environments, and you have the option. Do you wall them off or at vast expense, or do you pay the bills when it happens and people die or whatever? And these are very serious problems which are going to come home to roost more and more, I think, in the next century.
Andrea Dutton, let's bring you back in here. It sounded like the work that you're doing suggests that the average global sea level can rise 20 to 30 feet?
Yes, that's right. So this time period I mentioned before, the last interglacial, where it was only a couple degrees warmer at the poles. What we've done is we've gone back and looked at what elevation we can find fossil corals. So corals grow close to the sea surface, and that's one method we can use to reconstruct where sea level was in the past. So a lot of the sites that I go to, you can see these corals sticking way above sea level now. And we've determined that the peak sea level during this time period was probably between about 5.5 to 9 meters above present sea level. So that's something like 18 to almost 30 feet.
Do we have a sense of how soon that will happen?
That is the multi-billion dollar question, right? We know that sea level rise is inevitable in our future. And so what we want to know, what everyone wants to know, is how much, and in particular, how quickly is that going to happen? That's a very difficult question to answer because the models that we have about the physics of how these ice sheets will respond dynamically like this are basically not good enough for us to do good projections into the future. And that's why I've taken the approach of looking into the past, and we're trying to determine when these things happen, when do ice sheets collapse, and how quickly does that happen. At this stage, we can't tell you how quickly. We know that it obviously takes some time. So as you warm the Earth's atmosphere, it will take some time for the ice sheets to respond. But a lot of the research that's come out, even I'd say in the last decade, is really pointing us towards thinking that the ice sheets can respond a lot quicker than we used to think they could. So it's not going to happen overnight. You're not going to get 30 feet of sea level rise, right? But the point I like to make to people is you really have to start to think about what commitment are we making to sea level rise? Because if we warm the atmosphere by, you know, a couple degrees at the poles, we're going to cross that within a matter of decades, right? So we may be committing ourselves to this type of sea level rise in the future for the future generations.
If we look into history, sometimes it's a good predictor, sometimes it's not a good predictor to the future. What can we look at historically that might give us some guidance? Brian Fagan?
Practically nothing. I mean, as Andrew's pointed out, and this is really important research they're doing. I mean, they're really attacking the million-dollar question. The basic variable is there were just so many people. And there is no precedent which really would tell you how people will react and what we can do. We're really on our own, in my humble opinion.
Andrea?
So historically, there actually is a lot we can learn, not necessarily about what's going to happen, but what has happened tells us a lot about the system. So if we look at, there are sea level records that have been generated over, say, the past 2,000 years in great detail, looking at salt marsh sediments. And what they tell us is that for most of that 2,000 years, there were pretty minor changes in sea level. But in the late 1800s, that sea level started to rise dramatically, just about the same time as temperature rose dramatically due to industrialization and putting CO2 into the atmosphere. So what we can say is this type of sea level rise within the past 2,000 years is unprecedented, right? So we can see there's this really rapid response of sea level to changes in temperatures, and that's an important thing we can take away from the historical record.
Yeah, but it's a fairly shallow historical record by my standards, but she's absolutely right. This is very, very important.
Brian Fagan, would you say, since you're kind of looking at this from the big picture of what are we going to do as a humanity, would you say that primarily what people have to do now is start planning to adjust?
Yes. I think a number of things got to happen. I think one of them is that we've really got to start thinking about this. It's a political issue. It's a very complex economic and social issue. And we really need to start planning. The problem is that our whole system and life is set up for short-term thinking. And this is a problem for our great-grandchildren. About the only people who are thinking about this in the long term that I know of are the Dutch. And they're planning for, Andrew may know the figure, but I think it's 100,000-year events, something like that. And that's a very long feeling. And even them, I know, are having some resistance from the present generation. Why should we pay for this? And things like that. These are the sort of issues which are going to become more and more prevalent as this situation intensifies. But at the moment, there is no serious thinking about it in most countries in the world.
Andrea Dutton, where do you see the future of your research with what you've now discovered?
One of the things we're trying to figure out now is it's pretty clear to us that during this last interglacial period that the West Antarctic ice sheet pretty much collapsed. So large portions of this ice sheet are currently grounded below sea level. So it can be pretty sensitive to warming ocean water from underneath the ice shelf, and it can retreat very rapidly. So we're pretty sure that this collapsed during that time period, and we're debating about when it happened, under what conditions, and how quickly. So this is one of the directions that we're moving into, and we're trying to understand, you know, did sea level rise gradually, or was it very rapid? Is it kind of a nonlinear response? Those are the types of things that are going to be really important knowledge to have as we move into the future.
Where were you publishing all this?
The paper that she mentioned was published in Science last year.
I must look for it. When I tell you I've spent the last 2 years looking about ancient animals, you will understand. What Andrew's doing is of enormous importance, because what they're addressing, they're using the remote past, the recent past, to look at what might happen. And they're doing it in very realistic terms, which is scientifically intelligible to a wide audience. And this, to me, is enormously important. I'm very excited, and I'm now going to follow up and read this.
Well, great. Well, thank you both so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
Andrea Dutton is a professor in the Department of Geological Sciences at the University of Florida. She is the author of Ice Volumes and Sea Level During the Last Interglacial that was recently published in the journal Science. Brian Fagan is an emeritus professor of anthropology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He's the author of more than 40 books, including his latest, The Attacking Ocean, The Past, Present, and Future of Rising Sea Levels. When we come back, what most of the world has gotten wrong about Muslim fundamentalism. Stay tuned. You are listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In many parts of the world, fundamentalism is on the rise, oppressing human rights, sometimes using bodily harm and even death. Simultaneously, the international community has been ineffective in helping the scholars, journalists, human rights advocates, and artists who are struggling against the oppression. How bad is the situation, and what can be done. Three experts join us. Karima Benoun is a professor of law at the University of California Davis School of Law. She is the author of Your Fatwa Does Not Apply Here, Untold Stories from the Fight Against Muslim Fundamentalism. Husseina Alidou is a professor and the director of the Center for African Studies at Rutgers University. She is the author of Engaging Modernity, Muslim Women and the Politics of Agency in Postcolonial Niger, and Women, Gender, and Freedom of Expression, Sub-Saharan Africa. Sadia Abbas is professor of English in the program in Women and Gender Studies at Rutgers University. Her publications include the forthcoming At Freedom's Limit, Islam and the Postcolonial Predicament. She has also authored The Echo Chamber of Freedom, The Muslim Women and the Pretext of Agency. Welcome to the three of you. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle. Karima Benoun, I would like to start with how you open your book, which is your own experience in Algeria during a time when religious fundamentalists were killing scholars, journalists, trade unionists, others. You had a personal experience with your father. What happened?
Yes, I always say that I did not come to this subject by choice. It's really a topic that came to me. So the book opens in 1993, which was a time of increasing assassinations in Algeria of intellectuals by the armed fundamentalist groups that were battling the state. As one local newspaper described it, every Tuesday, and specifically every Tuesday morning, a researcher fell to the bullets of the fundamentalists. So one Tuesday morning, a week after the killing of a colleague of my father's in front of his own daughter, somebody showed up at our house early in the morning and was pounding on the door, would not go away. We couldn't figure out who it was. My father tried to get the police on the phone, and the local police, I think perhaps partly because of all the attacks on police officers, they themselves did not answer. And we were left there to face whoever was on the other side of the door. Now, we were lucky that day. Whoever it was went away. But somebody would come back soon after and leave a note on the kitchen table that said, consider yourself dead, and they would write death to on the mailbox in front of our name. And as I say in the book, the world looks different once you've seen death to before your name.
You also noted in your book that in many parts of the world, fundamentalism is rising and getting worse.
So the project of the book really was to go out and find the people today who are doing the work that my father was doing back in the 1990s and to try to bring them some of the attention and international solidarity that my father and his colleagues did not receive at that time. So I actually set out and interviewed close to 300 people of Muslim heritage from nearly 30 countries, from Afghanistan to Mali. And what was really striking, given the diversity of the context, I mean, I visited diaspora populations in Europe. I went as far as Fiji. I was in Egypt and Tunisia. What I heard almost everywhere was that this was a growing problem that people were increasingly worried about. And so my hope really in the book is to tell some of their stories and to really try to bring them some transnational support, because their opponents certainly have transnational support, that funding that comes from outside and so on. So that's what the book is really about. It's also about trying to challenge some of the discriminatory ideas about Muslims and people of Muslim heritage in the West by showing their tremendous diversity and by really answering that question that we've all heard so many times, where are the Muslims that speak out? How come no Muslims speak out? Well, in fact, they do. They're just not always the ones with the microphone, and I'm trying to change that at least a little bit.
Let's talk about some of the people that you interviewed. You found some, what I would say, common themes. What would you say the most common themes are across the people that you interviewed?
Well, I would say one thing that I heard about from people, whether it was in Pakistan or whether it was in Niger, was a sense of not having the space to express oneself, not having the space to do this work, and the real need to create the spaces in which these kinds of views can be heard, and these sorts of people can have their activities. And there was a very interesting example that I came across in Karachi in Pakistan, of somebody actually opening a cultural center called T2F in a cafe, precisely to try to create a space for people through artistic expression, through lectures, and so on, to be able to come together and face off against the fundamentalists. Another common theme that I found across the regions was the sense that women were target number one of the fundamentalist groups, And in fact, a colleague of Professor Ali Duz, Zainabu Hadari, said to me, she said, every step forward in the struggle for women's rights is a step forward in the struggle against fundamentalism. And I think that that's absolutely true. And it's no accident that the chapter about women's rights defenders is the longest chapter in my book.
Some of the experiences were quite harrowing. For example, in Mali, you had the experience of the activists who had their limbs cut off and were beaten publicly for something as simple as wearing the wrong veil. How prevalent is this?
Abuses that you're referencing occurred in Mali in 2012 when the northern half of that country was occupied by jihadist armed groups. And the thing that really stays with me are the people who were challenging those who were carrying out amputations and floggings and so on. And I interviewed an amazing school teacher who I call in the book Mr. Bodmar for his safety. That's what he asked me to call him. And he was keeping his school open in Gao, his hometown, that was occupied by Mujahideen, which is one of the armed groups allied to Al-Qaeda. And he would continue to educate boys and girls together in his classroom and remain there, even though it was very dangerous. But he said that this gave hope to his students, and he couldn't take their hope away from them. And then, and this is where the amputations piece of the story comes in, he did this incredibly courageous thing, which is that he would force himself to go and witness every use of corporal punishment by the local jihadists. So every time that they would amputate hands or feet of people accused of theft, or they would flog people in public because of dress and so on, when this was announced ahead of time, he would go to witness so that he could try to assist the victims afterwards, and so he could try to document what was happening in his home city. And he was really haunted by this, but he forced himself to keep going, to sort of write the history of his hometown. And now the jihadist occupation of Gao has ended, although there's a great deal of concern that when the international troops that chased the jihadists out leave, which is to happen shortly, they may in fact return. So these practices are not continuing at the moment in northern Mali, but the fear is that they would start all over again. And in fact, it goes back to your earlier question, this issue of threatening to use these kinds of corporal punishments. This was something else that I ran into in many different contexts. In some places, it may only be rhetoric. In some places, there may be only a few instances. And in some places, you know, we see, such as in Iran, you know, the use of some of these practices becomes very widespread.
Hossaina Alidu, let's bring you in. You have been looking at these issues related to women in Kenya and Niger. How have their experiences compared with the experiences that Karima Benoun has found in her book, Your Fatwa Does Not Apply Here?
Thank you very much for inviting me, and congratulations, Karima, for bringing this book out. Yes, there are convergences in terms of Karima's findings and also my work in Niger and East Africa. So for me, starting from Niger, a predominantly Muslim country, and I'm from Niger too, I went back to Niger in the 90s to do my doctoral research on a totally different topic. But what was surprising to me as somebody coming from Niger is the way in which the landscape has changed, with all of the sudden Islamism marking itself on people's bodies, something that I have not experienced as a Muslim person growing up in Niger. And here is a Muslim person who was raised in a Christian school, because the Muslims trusted that their children will be well-raised, and they trusted Christian, because I attended a Catholic school from kindergarten to the end of high school. And the majority of the students, I went to all-girls school, were from Muslim communities. And we were not forced, either by the Muslims or by the Christians, to make religion as a way of marking our life or our space, in a way of differentiating or discriminating against somebody. So here in the 90s, all of a sudden you see this bodily presentation by the way that Islamism is marking itself and insisting on how now women, actually both men, women and men, should look like. So from there, it creates what I'm calling a different traditions, and a tradition which invites violence, because it's either you cover yourself in a way that is required by the new way of marking your piety, or you are not a proper Muslim. I grew up, and many of my friends, and they continue up to today, wearing pants, skirts, and you dress whatever you want. And if you know West Africa, we like to dress, and we like to show up the hair design on all sorts. But all of a sudden, with this new way of being Muslims, all that have changed. So I thought, as a linguist, I have to finish my research, but come back to write this new story about women and the implication that it will have in terms of the violence, in terms of bodily integrity, but also the psychological violence. And I saw it was gendered in the sense that even with men, now men also have been required through this adherence of these new ways of being Muslim in a fundamentalist way of appearing physically. You have to wear beard, you have to wear pants that are shortened, and the fashions, the diversity of male fashion that existed in the Sahelian landscape began to be also questioned, right? And girls going to school, like there's some school where they're required to wear some skirt or to wear uniform. If it is not the type of things that they want, this new fundamentalist Muslim wanted, then the girls are aggressed in the streets. And that led to a march of the women in Niger to say, no, you cannot aggress our daughters and you cannot aggress us. In my work, I try to show the difference, because we also have to make to be careful in the different nuances and the use of language of expressing what it is that is happening. A Muslim society, just like other societies, had both liberal and conservative. And within that, that does not make them fundamentalists. What is the problem here is the violence, the insistence that there is only one way of existing. And I observed that in Niger, and I studied that in Kenya. And I thought it's important to bring the typology of those structures that exist and how fundamentalism is actually very, very different from the old tradition of ways of being Muslim for both women and men. And then how it is really very dangerous if it is not addressed. And then fundamentalism of Muslims also called is very similar to the kind of reactive things, because if you are in predominantly Muslim society, you have like Niger, you have Islamic fundamentalism, it produces reactive responses of producing Christian fundamentalism, which has a negative consequences for minority Christian women in a predominantly Muslim society. My research in Kenya shows that there is a fundamentalism of Christian in East Africa, places like Kenya and Uganda, and it produces the other side of a conversation, and sometimes they marry each other with Islamic fundamentalism. And this is very dangerous, and we have to do something about it.
I wanted to kind of get clarity on a couple of items. I think I heard you say other side.
Yes.
And you mean by other side?
Religion in Africa. I want to use an expression that a colleague called Dora King has used, that religion in Africa is a marketplace, you see? So what is happening is, now that I have done both research in predominantly Muslim societies in Africa, like in Niger, where I come from, and in minority Muslim country like Kenya, when you have fundamentalism, right, fundamentalism of Islam is a bedfellow to fundamentalism of other faith. So I give you one example. As Islamic fundamentalism is rising in Niger, it produces a type of fundamentalism that people are not watching, that has a problem for the women of Niger who are of non-Muslim background, because it's reactive to Islamic fundamentalism. So you have Christian fundamentalism through Pentecostal churches responding, and at times also they are on the same platform on issues like abortion or gay rights. Both Muslim fundamentalism and Christian, and also traditionalist other monotheistic religion, will come to be together, you see?
Yes. One of the things you said is, by marking the bodies, which it sounded like you were talking about the dress code,
yes.
You said it invites violence.
Yes, it is a form of, first, if they do not take arm literally, I think it is a form of violence. I should not be forced to be dressed a certain way in whatever context, especially through the use of religion, which will also create a condition where a fatwa would be issued that if you do not dress a certain way, that there is a right for those people who want to aggress you to force you to come to the right path by dressing the way they want. In West Africa, we wear bubus, which are beautiful designs, traditionally conceived within West African aesthetics. I don't see why I have to be forced to be dressed like somebody who is coming from Saudi Arabia or from South Asia or Iran if it is not what I decided by choice to be my fashion.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about what most of the world has gotten wrong about Muslim fundamentalism. Let's bring Sadia Abbas in. Sadia Abbas, first of all, there's something that you also wrote that speaks to this struggle also from the pressure of the West. You used the phrase freeing themselves from freedom. What did you mean?
Thank you. Could I respond first?
Oh, please.
Your question?
Yeah.
Just because I'm sort of, you know, thinking with everyone here, which is one of the points that Sana made, and I think that Karima has, even in her example from Karachi, which is where I grew up, in, by the way, a profoundly conservative family. And my father is an Islamist, and I say this only because he's also one of the only members of the family I can talk to, right? So we fight, but we also talk. And many of my thoughts are formed sort of in a kind of, kind of heated dialogue with him. And I think that's important because despite everything, when I was growing up in the 70s and 80s in Pakistan, Pakistan was a very different place. And I think that's a theme that you'll hear from, you've already heard from the other two people here, which is that it was, you know, forms of self-expression were different, forms of address were different, and by different, I don't mean that everybody has started, dressing differently now. I mean that there was less pressure to conform to a perceived monolithic religious identity, right? And that started changing in the mid-1980s. One of the things that Asana said, I think, is very important because what I've argued in my own forthcoming book is that this modern form of Islam is fundamentally anti-customary, right? That it is anti-cultural, it's anti-customary, and it goes against all kinds of, lived forms of Islam. The pressure here is complicated because, as I'm sure you know, Pakistan became the place that it did. I mean, its religious identity became as exacerbated as it did under Zia-ul Haq, the military dictator who ruled from 1977 to 1988, who had massive American support. So what happened in Pakistan could not have happened without large amounts of funding from the United States and the Cold War. It would have been impossible. The irony of the current moment is also that as those alliances have imploded, the Islamists now have the identity of being anti-imperialists and anti-West, right? And of course, way back, I mean, not so far back, but about 20 years ago, they were seen as the allies of the Americans. It was the left in Pakistan that accused them of being imperial allies. So one of the things that's happened now, and there's a kind of weird symbiosis between the international left and what's going on in the ground and the conservative sections in many parts of the Muslim world, is that because George Bush used the language of freedom, right, to quote-unquote liberate many parts of the Muslim world, what's happened is that a conservative Islam has been produced or is now perceived as being somehow constitutively anti-freedom, right? That we do not want Western-style freedom is something that people will repeatedly say. And the Islam that is perceived as most as the other of Western-style freedom is, in fact, conservative modern fundamentalism, right? So many young people will sign on to that version of Islam because they want to, and that's the paradox that I play with throughout my book, free ourselves from freedom. What does that mean? It just means that it's a kind of anti-imperialism that accepts, ironically, a certain segment of the West's presentation of itself. And my argument is that that's not something we should believe historically anyway.
Karima Banoon, let's bring you back in then, because I think one of the arguments of your book is that the international community has largely failed these human rights movements, whether they are peace movements or women's movement. If you're going to say how they've failed and how they might correct that failure, what would you say?
Well, one of my frustrations is that currently in the West, we see that there seem to be largely two available discourses. Some on the right, which are openly discriminatory, that suggest that sort of all Muslims are fundamentalist or Islam is inherently fundamentalist, and that's clearly offensive and wrong. But then we also see, unfortunately, sometimes on the left, and Professor Abbas referred to this, we see in the West, on the left, a certain political correctness that makes people silent about these issues, or even sometimes in the worst case scenario, sympathetic to the fundamentalists who are cast in the role of being anti-imperialist. And what I'm arguing is that both of these sets of discourses that we encounter are insufficient, are inaccurate, are inappropriate responses, and they actually undercut the people on the ground who are doing this work. And so what we need to do is to actually start listening to them about how they perceive the threats from fundamentalism in their contexts and what kind of solidarity would be important. And I was really struck by what a Malian woman lawyer said to me about how hard it is to do this kind of work, you know, by yourself. And so a big part of what I'm doing is trying to break that wall of isolation. I think there's a range of ways the international community can support these people. I mean, one of the first things, obviously, is not to support fundamentalists in the first place, whether they are fundamentalist governments like the Islamizing dictatorship of Zia al-Haq, to which Professor Abbas alluded, or whether they are non-state movements like the Mujahideen in Afghanistan that we supported in the U.S., supported the most extreme of the Mujahideen, regardless of their ideology, because they were fighting against the Soviet Union. And that has had terrible, lasting consequences, both for the Afghan population, but also for the populations in other countries, because many young jihadis came and got their training there and then took that training home with them. So that's the first thing, not to support fundamentalists. Then, secondly, to find creative ways to support those who are standing up for equality and tolerance and real substantive democracy, whether it is through finding ways to help fund their projects, whether it is bringing them to the U.S. to actually speak, whether they speak English or not, so that we get to hear from them, whether it's translating what is being written in Urdu, in Arabic, in French, in so many other languages about these issues. I think it's absolutely critical that we find a new response. And I wanted to respond to something that Professor Alidou said, because I thought it was very well put what she said about this new way of being Muslim. I think people have to understand this. What we're talking about here in regards to fundamentalism are political movements of the extreme right. This is the definition I cite in my book. So these are political movements that are exploiting religion, that are using religion for political purposes. And I think that really has to be understood. This is not a conservative project about protecting tradition. This is, in fact, about radically changing the way that people live their lives in many different Muslim-majority contexts. And many people of Muslim heritage are standing up and saying, this is not the kind of change that we want.
Hussaina Alidou, how would you say the West should respond?
I think it's important to look at the place of women as the key agent of social changes, democratic social changes that are taking place from grassroots all the way to all different instances of society. Most of the time, what I think that when people speak of societies, it's always from the point of view of a segment. So the representation that we get, the voices that we get of who are these leaders of Muslim societies, the discourse is always focusing on the fundamentalism. So it's giving them a more platform. And yet there are women and men who are challenging that, but who are not being given the proper platform to address issues about societies and the right of groups and individuals to exist and also to be empowered. If the West want to do development projects, why is it that those other segments the multiplicity of alternative ways of living in a peaceful way, respectful way, and tolerant way are not addressed. That's, to me, where we have to have a conversation and to see the central role that women play in society.
Sadia Abbas?
Two things. One is start listening, which we haven't done, and that would involve, and the we is complicated here because I live here and I've lived there and I go back and forth, but that can only happen if we give up certain assumptions, one of which is that Muslims are not free of ideology like any other group. You know, there's a whole variety of them, and that's why Karima's book is so important, because she has, tried to listen to other people as well, right? Not the ones who get standardly kind of hyper-visibilized because they happen to be the figures who are, fit the model of Western security, right, or terrorology, as somebody I know calls it. So, you know, we listen to these fundamentalists or the Islamists because those are the ones who seem most intriguingly different, but they also sort of fit the discourse of security. And the other thing is to not assume that, you know, political and religious identities are seamless and that they fit together tightly in the Muslim world in the way that they don't, or in within Muslim majority societies or Muslim communities in the way that nobody assumes they do here in the West, right? And again, that's complicated because there are Muslims here. So kind of vision of this lump of people out there who apparently all are so similar that we can listen to one particular group and they're going to represent everything that Islam can produce through that. And that, I think, is constituted by a certain Islamophobia, right? Because it's assumed that Islam can only produce reactionary thinking. And then because that is taken to represent Islam, that's the only people that we listen to. And that's both fundamentally disrespectful to a good many people in the world. It's also not accurate.
Thank you for being with us, Hosseina Alidu and Sadia Abbas, Karima Benoun. Thank you so much for your work, and thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Karima Benoun is a professor of law at the University of California, Davis School of Law. She is the author of Your Fatwa Does Not Apply Here, Untold Stories from the Fight Against Muslim Fundamentalism. Hosseina Alidu is a professor and the director of the Center for African Studies at Rutgers University. She is the author of Engaging Modernity, Muslim Women and the Politics of Agency in Postcolonial Niger, and Women, Gender, and Freedom of Expression, Sub-Saharan Africa. Sadia Abbas is professor of English in the program in Women and Gender Studies at Rutgers University. Her publications include the forthcoming At Freedom's Limit, Islam and the Postcolonial Predicament. She has also authored The Echo Chamber of Freedom, The Muslim Women and the Pretext of Agency. That's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to the Scholar Circle team who makes this show possible, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Leonardo Alanis, and Joe Pinto. Most of all, thank you for listening. And if you missed a part of the show, you can go back either to the kpfk.org audio archives, or you can go to scholarcircle.org. You can hear us on iTunes and on Stitcher, and you can follow me at @armudian. Thank you.